Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your reoccurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest chapter, the latest edition, the latest great adventure on Planet Porky, Life on Planet Porky, the podcast with myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, rocket writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Miss Jones, how are you this fine day?
Yeah, very good, actually. I've already been out, and it's fresh, and it's full of hope out there today, I think.
That's right. There's a doctor in, I think it's the Mail, Dr. Max Mosley, is it? And
Michael Mosley, yeah.
That's right. I read his bulletins all the time, you know, pick up tips of my heart and all that. He says the, you know, one great way to keep yourself healthy is an early morning walk every day, if only for 10 or 15 minutes. And I have to say, I mostly do that because I go down to my newsagent down in the village, so to speak, down the hill, and pick up my papers and then come back. And problem is, the papers are getting later and later every day because, you know, production techniques are not like they were in your day and mine when they could produce five different editions of the paper. They tend to produce an early one, which is available at about midnight, and a late one, which doesn't get out till about 7 o'clock these days. But anyway, that's the way the business has gone. But that early morning walk, it really wakes me up. It does me a power of good. Last weekend, of course, the clocks went back, and I fell for it as usual and got up an hour the wrong side of the clock, you know what I mean, because I've forgotten to put my clocks back.
How old are you? You're still not used to this.
I know. Do you know
what? It's ridiculous, isn't it?
It is ridiculous. Most of the clocks in my place go back automatically, you know, but one of them didn't, and that's the one I was looking at. But anyway, there we go. Years ago, when I was the news editor of the Daily Express, a girl came in late on Monday morning. She should have been there. Reporters normally started at 10 o'clock, okay? I mean, not when I became news editor, I wanted them there at 8 o'clock, but it was always sort of 10 o'clock, you know. It was a very lazy sort of regime in Fleet Street, as you know, because it was run by people who like to spend all day in the pub and not take any responsibility for anything. But anyway, so she came in at 11 o'clock, and I said, "Where have you been?" She said, "I haven't been anywhere." And I said, "Officially, you're an hour late." I said, "The latest you can come in the mornings is 10. I've encouraged you all to come in earlier than that. What do you think you're doing coming in at 11? She said, "It's not 11. It's 10. I said, "Are you trying to, you know, mess me around or something?" She had gone right the way through the previous Sunday, been out socialising, went out for Sunday lunch, without realising the clock had gone back and her watch on her wrist still said 10 o'clock. How about that?
Well, that's kind of detached, isn't it, really? I mean,
You're supposed to be a reporter, you know.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah. I do get it. But yeah. In her defence, if there's such a thing to be said, back then, no internet, no computers, no mobile phones, no anything screaming the time at us all the time. So if your only source of information as to the time of day was the watch on your wrist and you just hadn't clocked it, so to speak, pardon the pun, And you're not at work over the weekend. You know, I can sort of understand.
But what about, the news comes on at 9 o'clock and she switches it on and, oh, that's funny, the news has finished. You know what I mean? It never occurred to her that, you know, the times had changed. But anyway, that's for another day. Go on.
A question. Did we even have morning breakfast news in those days?
Well, it started when I was the news editor of the Express. You know, the very first one was the BBC, wasn't it? With Frank Boff in his sweater, Angela Rippon, I think. Was it in that, wasn't she?
One of the TV AM, wasn't it, that started out with the five of
them.
That was
David Frost, wasn't it? And a few.
David Frost, yeah. Anne Diamond.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, but I think they both came on around about the same time. And then, as usual, with all new ventures, they all, after 6 months, completely pulled it apart and put it back together again, which is what you always do with new broadcasting. But it was very exciting times. You know, we'd have reporters standing outside the TV AM studio every morning in Camden, up near Camden Lock, just to do stories about the presenters, never mind what they were talking about. You know, it was exciting times. I work with Anne sometimes now, and we often talk, you know, we go back and talk about how exciting it was opening up, you know, television 24 hours a day and all that. And I go back a long way with Anne, because when I worked in Birmingham on the Birmingham Evening Mail, Anne was on ATV, which was based in Birmingham, the Midlands TV station, run by that great TV mogul, Lord Lew Grade. Do you remember him?
Oh, vaguely, yes. I mean, I obviously know who he is, but I don't think I ever met him.
No, I did. He was a larger-than-life character, smoked a big fat cigar, drove around in the back of a Rolls-Royce and all that kind of stuff. But there we are. Talking about...
I tell you who I knew. Was it his son, Michael Grade?
No, that's his nephew. Funny enough.
His nephew, yeah, okay, because he was a big chum of my father's.
Oh, okay.
They played in one of the Showbiz 11 football teams together.
Right, yeah, I can.
And so he used to invite us to all kinds of stuff when we were kids.
Yeah, I mean, they were a huge Showbiz family. There was Lew Grade, and then I think his brother was Leslie Grade, but I'm prepared to be corrected on that. And Michael Grade was the son of the brother. But Michael Grade went on to be incredibly successful. He was head of the BBC, you know, like chief executive, I think, of the BBC, whatever they call it, the BBC.
Controller,
programme controller, you're absolutely right.
He was the thin controller.
The thin controller, that's right, absolutely right. He ran Channel 4, didn't he, for years?
Yeah, he did.
Head of Channel 4. And I've met him a few times, believe it or not, in the company of football bosses, you know what I mean? Because he would have been involved during the length of his career in negotiations for football rights and all that kind of stuff, you know what I mean? And always found him terribly, you know, affable and pleasant and all that. Just going back to newspapers for a minute, because, of course, I have an obsession about newspapers. But we've been reading over the last couple of days that the BBC are now going to boil down a lot of their local radio stations, okay? I don't know if you've picked up on this, Miss Jones. You usually pick up
Indeed.
On all these issues. And it means there'll be a merger of some local stations so that they're both running the same shows. Like, for instance, you know, if it's Radio Kent and Radio Essex, they might merge them for some parts of the day. I'm not saying that they are doing that, but that's just an example, you know.
They do that already, actually, in some of these places. When I do a lot of radio interviews when I'm promoting books and so on, and you might find that a particular programme that you're appearing on is going to go out on BBC Kent, BBC Essex, BBC Sussex.
That's right.
And these presenters straddle those several stations.
Yes, they do.
So I think they've been trialling this for quite a long time.
Oh, they have. But now I think they're going to make it sort of more formalised. I think, you know, I think local stations lend each other interviews. You see what I mean? You know, if Kent have got a good one of you, they lend it to Essex. But I think they're going to sort of formalise the schedules. And one account I read was that from 6 till 2, some of the biggest stations like Radio Manchester and Radio Birmingham, things like that, will have their own distinctive programming, but a lot smaller stations might just have to merge into one. I think it's a terrible pity, because I have never really worked in local radio, although a lot of people in my business, in national radio, end up at the end of their careers actually going and getting a breakfast show on local radio. You see what I mean? They've had a lot of experience in national radio and, they calm down a bit and reduce their hours and go and do local. And there's a great there is a great feeling about locality, and I can recognise it with local newspapers, right? Now, I started on the Chester Chronicle. I know you came into the business via the sort of pop industry sort of route. I came in via the weekly newspaper route, and I loved working on the Chester Chronicle because you were at the heart of the community. You know, you went and saw people who ran all the local businesses and all the local associations, and there was a great feeling of a buzz around the city that you were, you know, digging up the news and putting it into the paper. Came out every Friday. There was your name in the paper with all the stories about people and pictures. And I really loved it. And I knew how valuable it was to everybody in the city. And so the local newspaper industry has been run down drastically. I mean, absolutely drastically, you know, where a lot of it's printed centrally now in regions rather than towns. And if that happens to local radio, it will be a terrible shame. Local radio and local newspapers, I think, are very close to their communities.
Oh, very much so. But I've always thought, you know, why didn't we follow the American model a bit more closely? Because syndicated radio and newspaper content is huge over there. Yes. You don't really have national newspapers in America.
No, you don't. It's too big.
You've got USA Today, which is a bit of a comic, and everybody else says, oh, the LA Times, New York Times, but those are specific to those two coasts.
They are, yeah.
But so much of the content of regional newspapers, as it were, local papers, is syndicated across the land.
It is. You're absolutely right. And some people make fortunes, you know. What was the name of that guy? Brush Limbaugh or some, what was his name? Do you know the other guy I'm talking about?
No.
Newspaper columnist and broadcaster, Rush Limbaugh, I think his name was. Or somebody will correct me on that when they listen to this. But, I mean, he would syndicate a column in 600 newspapers and syndicate a radio show over 1,000 stations, you know what I mean? Make absolute fortunes. But you're absolutely right, because he was one of the very best, then the quality for each local radio station, each local newspaper was very high. So there we are. Now, Ms. Jones, listen, our audience of millions would be very upset if we didn't touch on the big record story since we last put a podcast together. And that, of course, is the re-digitalising, relaunching, re-everything of what I would call the last normal Beatles LP, Revolver. But some say it was the absolute turning point LP of the Beatles, which turned them from four mop tops into the genius musicians that we remember them as.
Yeah, there's a lot of talk about this, isn't there, right? I have an inherent disapproval of remasterings, remixings, reworkings. The reason for that is that there's a danger that the younger generations become familiar with these reworkings of classic albums to the point that the originals are forgotten and eventually lost. Mm. And as talented as Giles Martin is, son of George Martin, the legendary Beatles producer, and he's done a lot with this. People are raving about it. I still feel that we should be cherishing the original Revolver because of what you just said.
Yeah.
It was a turning point for the Beatles. It did mark their coming of age as songwriters and musicians in charge of their instruments and of their imaginations as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. George Harrison had three records on Revolver. I don't think he ever had three records on a Beatles LP again until the White Album, did he?
Well, three tracks, I suppose we'd say, rather than records.
Three tracks, that's right, yeah. Tell you what was interesting in reading it all was that Revolver, now the one before that was Rubber Soul, wasn't it? And apparently George played the sitar for the first time on Rubber Soul, right? And one person who listened to Rubber Soul was Ravi Shankar, right? And Ravi Shankar, apparently the greatest sitar player in the world, listened to this and then went and saw George. He must have gone to, you know, Abbey Road or something like that, and said, I listened to you playing the sitar. It was not very good. You know, you don't know how to play this this instrument. I will teach you. And then for the next two or three years, George was the pupil of, you know, Ravi Shankar, and it improved to the point, I suppose, where, what was the one on Sgt. Pepper's? Was it Within You, Without You?
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. And
John Lennon.
Sorry?
John Lennon.
Within You, Without You was, wasn't that George's sitar track on the second half of...
But I think John wrote the song.
Did he? I didn't know that.
I believe so. Cool. I'll check that.
No, well, no, that's fine. I'm sure you're right. But anyway, there you go. So, another...
I have a bit of a downer on old what's-his-name, Ravi Shankar.
Oh, yeah, go on.
I always feel a bit negative about him. Mm-hmm. He's the father of the singer Nora Jones.
Oh, yes, I didn't know that.
But he never acknowledged her. He didn't acknowledge his her paternity, I suppose you'd say. Yeah. Her paternity, yeah. Yes.
Parentage.
Yeah. How do you ignore somebody like that? Somebody who's also become a fixture in the public consciousness.
Yes.
Doesn't it say rather more about you as a parent than it does about the child?
Well, I mean, goodness gracious me, relationships. You know, I mean, look at what's happening now with Harry and Meghan again. You know, more strains in the world's most famous family. There's strains in every family, aren't there? And it's very, you know, you knock on any door and you'll find a problem, won't you?
What do you think of the forthcoming book, Harry's Spare?
Well, I wasn't going to talk to you about this because I think it bores our audience, to be honest, because it's what everybody is now talking about on TV, and I thought we could get away from it. But just the cover itself and just that stare, that cold-eyed stare, right, straight at you, and the word spare... He might as well have just admitted that, look, I've got the biggest chip on my shoulder of anybody in the world, you know, because I was never going to be the Prince of Wales. And that, you know, cold-eyed stare looking at you, almost like it's the fault of the person who's just bought that book, you know. I honestly can't think of why he wants to emphasise how bitter he is. You know, you can say what you like about... The life he leads now and the effect Meghan had on him. The point is, he was born into one of the most privileged families in the world, and he wouldn't have been able to do anything in his life if that hadn't been the case. So stop moaning or get out.
I agree. Put up or shut up, really, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, but I love listening to Tom Bauer. Tom Bauer is a legendary author, isn't he, in our business, both journalism and writing books. He writes books about everybody, Tom Bauer. And I love seeing him on the television where he just tells it absolutely straight. You know, Harry makes a fortune from attacking and trying to destroy the family he came from. That's what Tom Bauer says, and I find it hard to disagree with that.
Yeah, me too. Moving swiftly on, indeed.
Now, you've stayed in some of the best hotels in the world, Miss Jones. You really have. And a new programme started on TV, and it caught my eye, the review. It's called White Lotus, and it's about 5, 6, 7-star hotels and what goes on inside them. Are you aware of the expression, could you send me an extra pillow?
Oh, yeah, it means ordering a prostitute.
Well, I didn't know that. How naive am I?
Did you not?
No.
Yeah, or a hooker, as they might say in America. But, yeah, that's what you're asking for, is a cool girl.
Yeah, I know. It's amazing, isn't it? And yeah, I have stayed in some of the best hotels in the world. And I must be. I am very naive, though, because I was in Romania once, okay? And just before I went to bed, the concierge said, okay, Mr. Parry, are you all right? I said, yes, I'm fine. And is there anything you would like before you go to bed? Is there anything you want for the morning?
Where were you saying again?
Is there anything you would like before you go to bed? Is there...
What country are you in, Mike?
Romania.
Oh, okay, right.
Yeah, cool. I did say that to start, Miss Jo.
Yeah, sorry, I missed that. Yeah. I was. No, your accent was taking me to Delhi.
Ha, 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 ha.
Ha, ha, ha.
No, this is Romania, okay? And I thought... I don't know what he's asking me that for, because you can't order papers, you know, like you do in an English hotel. And I've already sorted out my breakfast. And, of course, what he was asking was, would you like me to send a woman to your room, you know? Which is, I don't know, I suppose goes on all over the world. Maybe I'm just too naive.
How many millions of hotel rooms have you stayed in over your long and... essentially a brilliant career.
Yeah.
How many times have you stayed in a hotel and you've been asked if you would like something extra and not realised what they're offering you?
I must admit, it does sound terribly naive, but whoosh, it always went over my head. You know as well as I do, when you're away on a job, the only thing you are concerned about is the job. The only thing you're concerned about is having to get up very early the next morning and get on with the job and do it. You don't want any distractions, and you've got to be very wary of the opposition, maybe, you know, getting one over you and getting to the person that you're chasing first and all that. So it never really occurred to me. There was one time, sorry, you were going to say something.
No, I wasn't, but I will. I will. I was going to say, what if all you ever wanted was, in fact, an extra pillow? And not knowing about this code business, you called down to the front desk and said, can I have an extra pillow?
Yes, that's right.
What would happen then?
I don't know. It's very interesting. There was another country I was in. I can't remember where it was, but I think it might have been Belarus or somewhere. And I was in a taxi, and the driver said, you have to be very careful that, you are not taken advantage of. And I said, what do you mean? He says, when you get to your hotel, the concierge, he will offer you women. And I said, oh, right, okay, well, thanks for letting me know that. He said, yes, do not take any notice, because let me tell you, my sister can do much better for you. He's actually pimping his sister, this bloke, but
that is dreadful. Well, that really is scraping the barrel, isn't it, really?
Well, it is terrible. I was away once on football matters, right, a World Cup or something like that, and I can't get into any detail at all because it's too damaging, but we were in the same hotel as one of the teams. I won't say which team it was, but there was a bloke sitting in a chair outside a hotel room, which I knew was the room of one of the players of that international team. And I asked him what he was doing, and he was actually the brother of the lady who was in the room with the footballer.
Oh, no.
And he was keeping guard on the door.
Oh, that's grim, isn't it?
Yeah, it is grim, I'm afraid. But, we've all had strange lives. Getting back to pop stars for a minute, Miss Jones.
Go on,
I saw a really good talk with Prince Jackson on the telly in the last couple of days. Prince Jackson, of course, being Michael Jackson's son, okay? And what an eloquent and intelligent and bright and bubbly boy he was. And considering he was Michael Jackson's son, I think he was the baby that Michael Jackson nearly dropped off the balcony when he was in the hotel. Was it in China?
No, that was Blanket.
Oh, was it?
The one they call Prince Michael Jackson II now. Yeah, because Blanket's 20.
Right.
Prince, the one you're talking about, is 25, and there's a girl in between called Paris.
Oh, right.
Who's 24, yeah.
Right. Okay.
No, it was Blanket he dangled over the balcony.
Golly, yeah.
What an unbelievable thing to do.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, could actually have dropped his own child, couldn't he? But did, I don't know if you saw Prince Jackson talking, did you?
I didn't see the, because it was on Breakfast Telly. I never get Breakfast Telly, but yeah. I read the transcript of the interview.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, he seems a pretty stable guy, given all that's gone on.
Yes, he, that's what I mean. I'm surprised that, those children are so normal. But the other interesting aspect of it was, and I can't even remember who the interviewers were, because I think I saw him on more than one programme, but afterwards they had the discussion about the dilemma of still loving Michael Jackson's music, celebrating him as the king of pop, but then all the allegations, none of which I think were ever proved in court, about his relationships with young kids.
I suppose what we have to remember is that Michael Jackson was never convicted of anything.
Absolutely.
And he never served time.
Absolutely.
So we haven't really got that dilemma that we have with, say, Gary Glitter.
Yeah, that's right.
Where he's in prison right now. I think he gets out quite soon, actually. But, it's separating the art from the artist. It's the age-old dilemma.
Yes.
We wouldn't listen to Bach, Beethoven, Mozart, any of them, if we delve too deeply into their private lives.
No, I totally agree. I think the occasion was the 40th anniversary of Thriller. The video and the record, And I have to say, Michael Jackson's dancing in Thriller is the best dancing I've ever seen. It was like his hips and his shoulders were controlled by a puppet man with strings, It was utterly bewitching, in my view.
There was something otherworldly about Michael Jackson, and that, of course, was the root of all his problems. He wasn't really meant for this world.
Yeah.
He had a very, as they always do, a very dysfunctional, damaged, strange childhood.
Yeah.
His father put him and his brothers on the road as artists when Michael was about 5 years
That's
old.
That's right, yeah.
They were sharing...
It's easy as 1, 2, 3. It's easy.
Yeah, fantastic recording,
yeah.
But they were sharing dressing rooms with, strippers and saw all manner of things. Yeah. that little children should never be exposed to. And then they were having to get up and go to school the next morning.
Yeah.
So they were completely wiped out. And he rehearsed and rehearsed them. Mm. If Michael got the dance steps wrong, he used to beat him with a belt.
Terrible. Yeah.
You know, this was a horribly abused little boy. Yeah. And it's no wonder he grew up to be the freak that he was.
And wanted to retain his childhood by associating with children. I mean, that was one explanation for his rather strange behaviour. But
although there was found at Neverland, his estate in California, a huge amount of pornography.
Well, he also had a secret room, didn't he, where he'd take little kids and all that kind of stuff. And what did he call it? Jesus juice, was it, when he used to give them some alcohol and that kind of stuff. But anyway.
You know, I've read so much of this stuff as you have, and I've always asked the question, and nobody ever seems to be able to answer it, where were the parents who released their own innocent children into the care of this admittedly global pop superstar?
Oh, most famous man in the world. He was easily the most famous man in the world. I remember the picture when he went to somewhere like Denver or somewhere like that, you know, for a huge concert. And the local police chief assigned 400 officers to the security guard to go with Michael Jackson everywhere he went around the city. It was unbelievable. You know, convoys of policemen in buses and cars. But that's the effect.
But where were the parents? I would never have let my children. Having said that, I've got a very good friend called Jonathan Morris, who worked at CBS Sony for many years. He was Michael Jackson's right-hand man, his PR, for 28 years or something. Mm-hmm. And Michael was godfather to Jonathan's daughter, Mimi.
Yeah.
And Jonathan quite openly says, I left my kids in hotel rooms with Michael many times. Mm. Do you think I would have done that if I didn't trust him?
No, exactly. Absolutely right.
So who knows? Who really knows?
Who really knows? You're right. Hello, everybody. I'm going to brighten up your day by telling you about Harry's, the fantastic shaving experience. Harry's are not just the super sharp razor company people. They are much, much more. And you can start with a trial set that is absolutely free. You just have to pay for the delivery, okay? Now, in your trial pack, you get a unique engineered and weighted Harry's handle, a 5-blade cartridge, complete with precision trimmer, foaming shave gel, and a travel blade carrier, or cover, I should say, if you're on the move, right? Also, a hydrating night lotion spray as an extra special gift. Now, absolutely everything you need is there for the smoothest of shaves, okay? Your trial set is packaged in beautiful aquamarine containers that let you know you're in for something special. The weighted handle makes you feel you're holding something more than just a razor. And believe me, you are. The trimmer blade makes it so easy to get to those hard-to-reach places. The foaming shave gel makes the blade skim across your face like a skater on an ice rink, okay? And after a couple of splashes of night lotion, you'll feel your skin positively invigorated and looking healthier and healthier. Now, Harry's products are put together with 0% sulfates or dyes and are alcohol-free, absolutely nothing to cause you any concern. Everything is crafted by experts who've devised invigorating formulas, and you will feel the difference no matter what your skincare goals are. So, folks, make sure to support our podcast, Life on Planet Porky, and start your own skincare journey by redeeming a free Harry's trial set. All you cover is £3.95 for delivery. So just head to harrys.com/porky and have your trial set and free night lotion delivered to your door. Let me give you that one more time. That's harrys.com/porky.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Right, okay, folks, you are listening to A Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, rock chick writer extraordinaire Miss Leslie Ann Jones. Now, Miss Jones, I think you're of the wrong generation because I've come across a new set of people who are the descendants of or the inheritors of Wagdom, and they're called the Fads. And that stands for something to do with your father being a footballer. Is it footballer and daughter syndrome or something like that?
Footballers' aspirational daughters.
Ah, there you go. Footballers' aspirational daughters. And I had a look at this piece, and I have to say, it is quite remarkable the number of footballers who've now got beautiful young daughters who appear on things like Love Island and who are, what do you call them, like, you know, influencers and all that kind of stuff. And they're all very, very pretty. I've got a list of them here. So you've got Pep Guardiola's daughter. You've got Michael Owen's daughter. You've got Paul Scholes' daughter, Stephen Gerrard's daughter, David Ginola's daughter, Jamie Carragher's daughter, even Mourinho's daughter, even Jose, the special one. I mean, this is quite a new phenomenon, isn't it?
Well, it is. But, you know, I find it obscene. Call me old-fashioned, but... Right. Go to school, pass exams, go to college, yeah. Work hard to pay your bills. Yeah. This, you know, it's not called a fad for nothing. Mm. It's not going to last very long, is it? What are they going to do the other side of it?
Yeah.
Sit around spending their money. It's telling young people who can be influenced by these kinds of young girls that materialism is king.
Yeah.
And that it's all about making a lot of money very quickly through not very much talent other than your reflection.
Yeah. Well, you know, I say good luck to them. I think, you know, if you're born with two advantages, one, your father's very famous, and two, you're very good looking, I say cash in on it. Why not? You know, I mean, beautiful women cash in on being movie stars, pop singers, people with good voices cash in on being, you know, like Tom Jones, pop singer or great singer or something like that. Don't you have to use that which God gives you to the maximum advantage?
I think all things in moderation. I think what I'm trying to say is, yeah, fair enough, good luck to them.
Yeah.
But what is the message to young, impressionable girls here?
Mm. Well,
who are not them, who don't have their looks, who don't have the advantage of a famous footballing dad.
Yeah.
It's going to make a lot of young people feel bad about themselves.
Well, it is, but that's not a reason why you shouldn't do it. I mean, some of these...
Oh, I think it is. I think it definitely is.
So are you saying that, look, I could cash in on this, I could make £1 million. Some of them have actually made £1 million, you know, as being influencers and Instagram and all that kind of stuff. One follower here, 48,000 on Instagram, 48,000 followers. I mean, what I'm saying is, surely you're not saying that they should say, oh, I tell you what, I'm not going to cash in on the advantages I've got in life because I feel sorry for anybody who's not as good looking as me. That's a weird way of looking at it.
Oh, no. It's a very shallow world, all of this. And the people that they are influencing, the followers, don't forget, are people that would love to be them but never can be.
Yeah, but that's not...
It's fostering a culture of negativity. You've got to look more deeply into it, Mike.
Well, I don't see it that way, to be honest. I say good luck to them. And if they've made, you know, £1 million by the time they're 21 or 22, my view is that then... could enable them to go on and do other things, but they've made the money through being good.
Yeah, it's all right for them,
yeah.
But it's not okay for all the millions they've influenced.
No,
or the millions
fault.
Of followers.
That's not their fault, though.
It's cashing in on disadvantaged people.
I don't think it is.
Why can't you see that?
Well, listen, you could say the same about a pop singer. A pop singer sells millions of records to people who buy them because they like listening to the record, but will never have a hope of making a record like that because they haven't got the talent. It's the same thing, isn't it?
No, I think most of us don't listen to music because we aspire to be pop singers ourselves. Mm-hmm. We listen because music has a very calming effect on the psyche of the human. Music brings us all kinds of benefits in life. Mm-hmm. There's also the message of the lyrics. You know, we've often talked about the Beatles and the songwriting, which has delivered us dimensions of life in ways that we haven't thought about ourselves previously. You know, it's all to do with psychology, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, if you say so, then...
I never wanted to be a pop singer. I'm sure you didn't either. But that doesn't stop me being a music lover. Mm. It's a different thing.
Well, maybe you're right. I tell you what, I read a piece in one of the diaries about a guy called Hunt, Freddie Hunt, okay? And I wondered why he was in the diary until I realised he's James Hunt's son. But then again, I'm still wondering why would anybody publish a story about Freddie Hunt in a diary, only really because his father was the absolutely wonderfully flamboyant former world champion, James Hunt. But during the course of this story, one line comes out. It says, Hunt Sr. was rumoured to have slept with up to 5,000 women, but Freddie remains committed to his entrepreneur girlfriend, and they give her name. I can't get that 5,000 women thing. I've tried to work it out. James Hunt died, maybe not surprisingly, of a heart attack at 45 years of age, okay?
Not surprisingly at all. Yeah. I did some sums. If he started shagging around at the age of 20...
That's what I've worked out, yeah.
And he continued to 45, that's 25 years. Yes. 5,000 over 25 years is 200 a year. Yeah. That's 3.8 women a week. Yes, that's very possible. And I'm sure at one time in your life, you were doing 3.8 women
a week. Well, I wasn't actually. I mean, I don't want to play down my Lothario abilities when I was a younger man, but 3.8 a week is nearly four. So say four one week and then three the next week, okay? Never, ever, ever have I hit that sort of pace, honest to God. And I don't honestly really know any of my mates who did as well. I mean, that's just astonishing. You'd have to, I don't know, every other night you'd have to find yet a new girl. It would be so tiring, so exhausting just finding the girl, let alone then indulging in, you know, El flagrante, is it?
Il flagrante.
Flagrante. Yeah. I couldn't work it out, but...
Well, in flagrante, I think.
In flagrante.
No, but take your average rock star on tour in their heyday.
Right.
They're doing three, four, five women a night.
I suppose you're right, yeah. But
you know, so add that up.
Yeah. I read a story once, right? James Hunt was a very big mate of Barry Sheen. Barry Sheen, who people may or may not remember, was the world motorcycling champion, okay? At the same time as James Hunt was... I'm not sure if he was world champion. He was only world champion for 1 year, but he was top racing driver, top Formula One racing driver for a decade. And so at the same time, Barry Sheen, world motorcycling champion. And they would literally, whenever they went to a city overseas, if they were in the same place together, because sometimes the races were taking place at the same part of the world, or sometimes one would just accompany the other because they were mates and they had the same way of life. You see what I mean? And so, for instance, one time they were in Japan because James was racing in the Japanese Grand Prix. So they're in Tokyo and Barry Sheen went with him. And they always headed for the hotel where the British Airways crews were being accommodated from flights coming in from London, British Airways flights coming in from London. And they used to sit in the lobby, wait for the crews to come in, and then they would invite all the female air hostesses to a party in the penthouse suite that they'd rented, and the parties would go on for days, literally days. That's
what utter sleazebags.
Well, yes, but what a nice lifestyle, don't you think?
No, not really. Yeah. I think it's pretty shallow, isn't it, really? I suppose a lot of girls and boys go into working as airline crew because not just because they want to see the world, but they want to have a lot of sex while they're young and good looking. And I suppose why not if that's your bag?
That's right.
But it is ultimately shallow, isn't it? Because there's ships that pass in the night or planes that pass in the night, and they're not exactly going to form long lasting relationships with these people.
Well, you say that, but I wouldn't mind having that shallow sort of life for a few years.
Would you not? I think you're far too intelligent.
Sterling Moss, you know, probably the most famous racing
driver. Oh, he was a shagger.
He was a mega shagger, honestly, well into his 70s or even his 80s. And funny enough, he's the most famous racing driver in this country, but he never won the Formula One World Championship. He always missed out by a couple of points, but he was like James Hunt. He was, you know, very flamboyant and all that kind of stuff. But he told the story once. He was in whichever city it was. He must have been working there, you know, in broadcasting for a Grand Prix. He said, yes, James used to invite all these young ladies up to his suite for a party. He said, and remarkably, very few of them said no. So I thought.
Well, they all think they're going to be the one. This is the sad thing about us.
Oh, you keep saying sad. They're only having a good time, bit of rock and
roll. Oh, no. But women are not inherently like that. Women are all secretly hoping to be the one that he chooses to marry.
Right.
Well, that is the case.
I don't think he had that in mind when he invited them up to his room. I remember once, by the way, James also did a bit of broadcasting when he retired. But as I say, it didn't last long. He died at 45. No wonder, really. He lived in Wimbledon, not very far from where I am, up the A3 in Surrey. But he was doing it with Murray Walker. Do you remember Murray Walker? You know, he was a national treasure, wasn't he? You know,
very sardonic delivery, didn't he have?
Yes, that's right. But anyway, so Murray Walker turns to James in the commentary box and says, well, James, he got very excited, old Murray Walker. Well, James, look at the way that Nigel Mansell is putting the pressure on that car in front of him. What will that car in front be feeling now? And James Hunt said, Murray, the car itself won't be feeling anything because cars are inanimate objects.
State the bleeding obvious.
Yeah, that's right. He said, but the driver, on the other hand, the driver could be feeling rather nervous, you know. And
that kind of stuff. That's funny. Yeah. A friend of mine, he's a musician, very good one, yeah. Tim Hain.
Yeah.
He knew Stirling Moss very well, right. And he brought a great book out about him a couple of years ago. Oh, yeah. I can't remember the name of it, but it's by Tim Hain, and it's really brilliant. Mm-hmm. And he had a very close relationship with his widow as well. Wow. I think he still sees her, yeah.
Right, that's amazing. Now, what was I going to say to you? Yes, sadly, an old friend of mine has died, and I read his obituary in the Telegraph. Don't like to go on about, you know, obituaries and death and all that, but it does bring back great memories. This lad was, gentleman, Charles Lawrence, okay? And I knew him when he was the New York Bureau Chief of the Telegraph in New York City, and I was at the Daily Express Bureau. We were in the Superman building on 42nd and 2nd Street. That's the building where they filmed the first Superman film, when the helicopter crashed on the top of it and they used the newsroom because it was the Daily News building, whereas Charles and the Telegraph were in the Rockefeller Center, just over the other side of town. But we all used to get together on Fridays, and Charles was honestly, the ultimate Englishman in New York, you know, debonair, sophisticated, wore suits from Savile Row, all that kind of stuff. He was just the, you know, the image of the sophisticated Englishman. And famous story about him, which didn't happen in New York, was when he was a young reporter on the Evening Standard in London, he used to get an advantage because I'm sure you're aware, evening newspapers had to work much, much more quickly, had to go faster than daily newspapers, because the daily newspapers had all day to gather the news and print it overnight. Evening newspapers, you had to get it back in minutes to get it into that day's last edition, which used to come out at 4 o'clock or something like that. And so Charles used to keep a motorbike, you know, around the back of the building. As soon as the story wrote, whoosh, he was off on his motorbike. And one time he got a tip from, because we used to pay waiters, didn't we, all over town.
Waiters and doormen.
Waiters and doormen, all over town. Tell us if anybody's famous. He gets a call from, I think it was Scott's, the restaurant, famously, I think, where Nigella Lawson had a bust up with her husband, Mr. Saatchi. But he shot round there. Because he'd got a tip off that Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton had just gone into a private room there for lunch. And it was very shortly after they'd remarried, because they married twice, didn't they? And old Charles turned up, debonair as ever, conned his way through the restaurant, got to their room, expected to be thrown out immediately, but was then invited to join them for lunch, sit down and join them for lunch. During which, as Richard Burton got stuck heavily into the booze, which eventually killed him, of course, Elizabeth Taylor leaned over and whispered to him, "The problem is, Charles, he can't get it up anymore." which, you know, and apologies to our millions of listeners, because, of course, this is a family show. But that line became famous for him. And he even managed to have lunch and get out in time to file a story for the last edition. I mean, that was when newspapers were real fun, yeah?
Absolutely brilliant. I read a story about Charles Lawrence. He wrote a book about his mother's affair with a famous Czech spy.
Oh, yeah, I didn't know that.
But publication was halted.
What, for security reasons?
Well, I don't know, but so much for free speech, right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. No, he was a lovely guy, and I remember him fondly. Died of, I think, lung cancer or something. I don't remember.
Yeah, very sad. I got a message from a couple of his friends on Facebook.
Oh, yes.
Asking whether we could arrange to have the bells at St. Bry's tolled in his honour.
Oh, blimey, that would have been nice. Is that happening?
Yeah, passed it on to the rector. You know, it's not my remit, that.
No, sure.
But, yeah, the message went on.
Sure. Do we still have memorial services for journalists at St. Bry's?
Oh, very much so, yes. But it's all down to the newspapers and the family.
Yeah.
So we don't organise them, but we will be approached all the time. Yeah. I think some weeks we have about three a week.
Wow, I didn't know that, because they all stopped during COVID, obviously.
Yeah. No, they're back with a vengeance.
Oh, that's great. I didn't know that. But anyway, I'll keep my eye on that. Listen, I read a survey saying 8 out of 10 workers are looking for a new job because they feel undervalued by their bosses and actually hate their jobs. I can only say how terribly sorry I feel for somebody who's gone through life hating their job, because I think you may feel the same. I've absolutely loved my job all the years I've done it. There's been ups and downs, there have been stressful times, there have been sackings and appointments and bust-ups and walkouts. But generally speaking, I knew from day one I was in the right profession. And how do you feel for somebody who gets up in the morning, goes to work and is not looking forward to the next 8 hours?
Well, do you know, I think the vast majority of people feel like that. That they just work to live,
yeah,
as opposed to live to work, which is what we did, certainly when we were on Fleet Street.
Yes.
But I knew from the age of 5 that I was going to write for a living.
Well,
I just knew that. I always wrote stories. My dad obviously went into journalism after he stopped playing football for a living. So it was a sort of given for me that newspapers were luring me. Mm. And then that sort of developed into other things. Mm. But I think I always knew I would make my living with a pen.
Yeah.
And I think we're the lucky ones, frankly.
Yeah.
The vast majority of people do not have our luxury.
No, I totally agree with you. And as I say, I feel sorry. One point it makes is, it says that one of the reasons a lot of people don't like their jobs is because there's no acknowledgement of the hard work or effort they put into it, i.e. they never get a pat on the back. They never get an encouraging word from the boss. And I have to say, that is something which has sort of concerned me all my life. Whenever I was a boss, I always felt I got more out of the people by encouraging them, by praising them, by bigging them up. In last week's podcast, we talked about the bullying syndrome, didn't we, of bosses, you know, which wears you down. I always went the opposite way. And yet, in the later stages of my career, when I needed a bit of encouragement and I needed a lift and I needed people to tell me I was doing a good job, I wasn't getting it because management had then been taken over by groupspeak. Do you see what I mean? And younger people in groupspeak who didn't feel it was necessary to build that bond with the people you're working with.
Oh, and there was also a kind of thing that came in about if you're bigging somebody up, you're making other people feel disadvantaged and it's bad for their mental health.
Ridiculous.
You know, all that. Yes, the mental health thing, I feel very sorry for anybody who suffers in that way. But I think it's kind of gone too far.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I totally agree. Workplaces should be of human instinct rather than rules and regulations.
Definitely.
Miss Jones, you've been friends with many great pop stars over the years, Freddie Mercury, David Bowie. I read a piece by a colleague of mine, Mariella Frostrup, quite distinguished journalist and writer, and didn't realise Bono, the legendary singer of U2, has got a book coming out. So Mariella hopped on a plane, went over to Dublin and went to see Bono at his home, having known him since the age of 8. It's a great story. I mean, I know how close you were to David Bowie. He went and stayed at his house in Mustique and all that. But she's got a quite unique relationship with Bono, who takes people as famous as Bill Clinton when they visit his home down to the local boozer in his village, and they sit in the back room and drink pints of Guinness.
Ah, well, this is the Irish for you, you know, yeah. Endlessly approachable. But, yeah, she's known him since she was a child because, of course, she grew up in Ireland.
Yeah.
She was born in Norway, but her father was a journalist and moved to Ireland when she was about six, I think.
Right.
So she grew up knowing such people. She also married Richard Jobson in 1979. He was lead singer with The Skids, a punk rock group.
Yeah.
So she'd sort of moved in those circles for a long, long time. Yeah. But she's done lots of interviews with Bono over the years.
Yeah.
This wasn't by any means a one-off.
No, but I think it was because his book was coming out.
So she will get the exclusive because he will know, as we know, how this works, that she will write what he wants her to say.
Well, I think that's a bit harsh against a fan.
No, it's not harsh. No, it's realistic. If you've got a friend in the business, you much prefer to be interviewed by someone who's going to give you a good time.
Yeah, well, yes and no. You'd still expect them to be, you know, factual about it, wouldn't you? And observational and all that kind of stuff. But no, I understand what you're saying. You're not going to invite somebody to interview you, slagged off your last three albums, are you?
Definitely not. No. You're going to be barred.
I totally agree.
We always used to say when we were going on tour with bands and so on that, you know, effectively we had to give them a good write-up so that we'd be invited on the next tour.
Yeah, no.
If you trashed them... Yeah. You've killed your career.
Yeah, you're out, yeah. Just before we go, Miss Jones, and thank you to all millions of listeners for having tuned in today. I was intrigued. I'm sorry, we're back to the obituary column now. But intrigued to see that the man who invented Red Bull has just died. I think he was 90-something. But, I mean, what a way to celebrate your life, to be the person who invented Red Bull, probably the most famous drink in the world, do you not think?
Well, this is Dietrich Mateschitz you're talking about, Austrian guy. Austrian, yeah, wasn't he? But he didn't invent it. This is the funny thing. Everybody thinks he did.
Yeah.
But there was a drink in Thailand in the 70s called Kreting Deng, which translated means, it means red Indian bison is what it means.
Right.
And he did a partnership with the company that made the stuff.
Yep.
And they did a variation on the theme called Red Bull. If you look into the ingredients of this stuff, you will never drink it as long as you live.
I love it, by the way.
Apart from caffeine in very high doses, which is incredibly bad for you if you've got a dicky ticker, as they say.
That's true.
It contains a substance called taurine, which from the name of it, you can probably guess it's something to do with bull.
Yeah.
So it literally is the bile of the bull.
Wow, yeah.
From the bile, the animal's digestive system.
Sure, it's
pretty gross. Mm. And then they chuck in vitamin B, sugar, glucose, all of that.
Yeah.
Bit of fizzy water, bit of baking soda, bit of magnesium carbonate. Mm. If you were to drink more than five of these a day, which lots of young people do, to keep themselves awake while they're at school and college and so on, you can end up with a decline in your mental health. The milder side effects are anxiety, irritability, insomnia, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
The worst that can happen to you is you can have a heart attack.
Yeah.
So please don't drink this stuff.
Well, I used to love it. I've given it up now for some of the reasons you've just outlined, but I used to love it. It used to give me a real lift, you know. If I was doing a show and I wasn't in a position to have a proper drink, if you see what I mean, for whatever reason, probably because we weren't anywhere near a bar, I would have a couple of cans of Red Bull and I felt on top of the world, honestly. But the reason, of course, I had to give it up is because of my heart. You're absolutely right. And the most dangerous drink in the world, somebody told me, is Red Bull and vodka. Because Red Bull, as you quite rightly say, excites all your heart and all your nerve endings and all that, whereas alcohol takes them down. So you've got two competing substances in your body, one trying to lift you up, the other one trying to bring you down physically, and apparently it's a lethal combination.
Oh, literally uppers and downers, which is what killed people like Judy Garland. But I think that the other thing they don't advertise is that vegetarians should not drink this stuff because of the taurine content.
Yes. I take.
I know people who are vegetarian who drink Red Bull.
Yeah, yeah, but they probably don't realise. You absolutely can't.
This is what I'm saying. Unless you read the small print on the back of the tin, which you tend not to do, and see, oh, this contains the bile of bulls. I don't think I want to drink this.
Absolutely. There you go. Right. Okay, folks, that's it for another week. Thank you very much indeed for having joined us. Miss Jones, as ever, thank you for your time and your company and your terrific insight into all those wonderful stories. And folks, we'll see you again this time next week.
How many millions of hotel rooms have you stayed in over your long and essentially a brilliant career?
Yeah.
How many times have you stayed in a hotel and you've been asked if you would like something extra and not realised what they're offering you?
I must admit, it does sound terribly naive, but whoosh, it always went over my head. You know as well as I do, when you're away on a job, the only thing that you are concerned about is the job.
5,000 over 25 years is 200 a year.
Yeah.
That's 3.8 women a week. Yeah, yes, that's very possible. And I'm sure at one time in your life, you were doing 3.8 women
a week. Well, I wasn't, actually. I mean, I don't want to play down my Lothario abilities when I was a younger man, but 3.8 a week is nearly four. So say four one week and then three the next week, okay? Never, ever, ever have I hit that sort of pace, honest to God. And I don't honestly really know any of my mates who did as well. I mean, that's just astonishing. You'd have to, I don't know, every other night you'd have to find yet a new girl. It would be so tiring, so exhausting just finding the girl, let alone then indulging in, you know, El flagrante, is it?
Il flagrante.
Flagrante. Yeah. I couldn't work it out. When you get to your hotel, the concierge, he will offer you women. And I said, oh, right, okay, well, you know, thanks for letting me know that. He said, yes, do not take any notice because, let me tell you, my sister can do much better for you. He's actually pimping his sister, this bloke.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to six guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.